This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. Washington Wise from Charles Schwab is an original podcast that unpacks the stories making news there. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, we're going to talk about how food delivery suddenly became the hot new thing in Silicon Valley again, and whether that means we're right back in the same cycle that brought us a huge dot-com crash 2 decades ago. Later on, we have a piece of an interview from the Wall Street Journal's health tech conference last week between 23andMe CEO Ann Wojcicki and Wall Street Journal reporter Rolf Winkler. They talked about DNA testing, how it can help develop better drugs, and what happens when you learn maybe more about yourself than you really wanted to know. It's a really interesting interview. But first, we're in the news business, so of course, we all want to talk about the news business all the time. And Apple has some big ideas about the future of the news business. So let's get into that. Here with me now, as always, Joanna Stern in New York and Christopher Mims, sadly, no longer in front of my face. Where are you, Christopher?
Back in the attic.
Back in the attic. Joanna, you're in the studio. How's the studio?
Was that an Aerosmith album? Toys in the Attic.
Wow.
Is that like new Aerosmith, like 20 years after anybody cared about Aerosmith?
Yeah, it was like Ouch. Armageddon Aerosmith.
I bet you like late the Chili Peppers, Pierce.
Stadium Arcadium forever. Okay, so let's talk about Apple News, which was a big story that the Journal broke this week. Joanna, can you just like run down what's happening here? Apple's been talking about subscription stuff for the last couple of years.
I think I can summarize it in two sentences. So Apple is working on a news subscription service, but publishers are resisting because Apple wants to keep half of the subscription revenue, according to people familiar with the matter.
So basically, the idea
is sentences, but it was pretty. It was pretty short.
That was pretty good. I like it. So it's basically they want to do Netflix for news, right? You like get all your news sources into one place. You pay, I think, what is it, $10 a month keeps being the number thrown out there.
That makes sense since that's like what everything else costs.
Yeah. And then you just read as much as you want. And so then the idea is they would give half that money back to publishers and everybody's mad about that.
Right. And as far as you understand it, just this is how I understand it. Like you subscribe to the general service and you would get all of the partner's content or like the publisher's content in one. You wouldn't subscribe, like you wouldn't pay an extra $2 for the Wall Street Journal or an extra $1 for the New York Times.
Okay. So as a reader, I kind of dig this idea. Am I crazy?
I think it would be great in a way because you would get all of that subscription content for probably less than you would pay each of those publications independently.
It's the Spotify model.
Right. I mean, I say that it sounds great from the perspective of a consumer, but I'm not sure it sounds great as a journalist trying to make money off content.
Right. So I read this piece from Peter Kafka at Recode that I thought was very smart. And basically his argument was that it makes sense for all those publications that are probably going to have trouble building their own huge sort of digital subscription service, because we all seem to have reached a point where we can all agree that like ad supported online news only goes so far and only for so many publications. So the idea of like having this giant service where presumably lots of people will be in it because lots of people are in everything that Apple does. In theory, there's a lot of money to be thrown around inside that. So I can see how it makes sense. But then you get, you know, the big newspapers like ours and some others and really big any media company that's like able to build its own business. I can sort of see why it wouldn't want to be in there. But still, as a reader, like I love Apple News because it's just a one place I can go instead of having to remember 50 places to go and 50 different logins and no website can remember that you're logged in ever. And like as a product, it kind of makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, how I've been using Apple News is I have two core news apps on my phone, the Wall Street Journal and some other newspaper. And I look at those very frequently. But then I go to Apple News for like everything else. Because I can find like good, I mean, I don't know if it's the algorithms. I don't know if it's that I've, you know, said I'm interested in these topics when you do that onboarding exercise. But I find that everything else there, they do a really good job of surfacing things I may be interested in.
When I was interviewing a bunch of members of Gen Z, they like it because it's a default. So imagine that you are just coming into the news ecosystem. Default's very powerful. It's there on your phone. It works pretty well. So Apple News has tremendous power, and that's what makes Apple cocky enough to try this.
Does anyone else have in their Apple News like very frequent People magazine articles?
Yeah, I get a lot of Harper's Bazaar and People, both of which,
that makes
to be
me
honest,
feel
I don't
better.
Mind. I don't know that I would have specifically requested them, but
like I know a lot about Jennifer Aniston, and it's probably thanks to Apple News.
Oh, well, that I think I asked for on purpose, so that checks out.
It's a search term.
Like I've been thinking a lot about this with podcasts recently, where the Apple Podcasts app is not the best podcast app, and yet it is by orders of magnitude the most popular just because it's the one that's there. And being the one that's there is very powerful. And the same is true with Apple Music, where they have 50 million paid subscribers now because it's the one that's there, and you get a free trial
and
for signing up.
Isn't the same true of Apple Maps, by the way? Like, isn't it more popular on iOS than Google Maps?
By leaps and bounds. This is Wilson, our editor, always fights me on Apple Maps stories because he's like, nobody uses Apple Maps. I'm like, no. Everybody uses Apple Maps because it's there.
But Google is better.
Yes. Well, but it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I think the average person wants to download zero apps. So the ones that are there, as long as they're there, work. And news is pretty powerful that way. You have to download a lot of apps to get all your news now.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, I have two core news apps, but everything else, like, I'm really great with Apple.
So, yeah, what's interesting
I don't even know why I need the other apps. Don't tell our people that work in our building that we don't need their apps. I'd like to strike that from the record.
That's fair. No, did you guys ever use Texture, which was the app that Apple bought that is kind of going to be the basis of this news product?
No.
So, okay. So Texture was a perfect idea to me. It was Netflix for magazines, and it was you pay once, you get all these different magazines, you get their back catalogs, you get new issues. Instead of getting them all mailed to you, they just show up. And this was like particularly cool when it was on an iPad because they were just giving you basically PDFs of the issues, which didn't look great but sort of worked okay as long as the screen was big enough. And that never really caught on because I think it just didn't really work as a product. The PDF thing wasn't very good. Everything was slow to download and load. But I still loved the idea of just being able to go in and be like, I don't want to read Fish and Stream every month, but maybe there's a story every once in a while that I'd like to read, and they should get paid for that in some way that makes sense, but I'm not going to subscribe to the magazine. And that sort of experience where like all this stuff is in one place makes sense to me. And especially when it's not through Facebook, which has strange algorithms, and Google, which has strange algorithms. Apple at least seems to be a little more sort of clearly put together. Like there's things that are curated by humans, and then there's stuff that you've chosen. And it seems like that system actually makes a lot of sense to me. But the business case for it seems pretty complicated.
And I got to say that I think that they may have miscalculated in the same way that I think they may have miscalculated with their forthcoming TV offering, which I think it's pretty obvious they're going to announce on this March 25th event, where apparently all the celebrities have been invited.
Oh,
we're
really?
In a situation where the people who have the content are in control, right? This is why so many people suggested Apple should go buy HBO or something like this. This is why Netflix is splashing out so much on content. If Apple cannot get the content providers that people want to get to play ball, it's not going to work.
Yeah, what are the rumors right now already that they don't have HBO on board, they don't have Hulu on board, is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, and so if this new Apple News offering doesn't include the places that are creating the news, and it's no offense to our peers in the magazine industry, it appears to be a bunch of magazines, you know, one of two things happens. Either it doesn't work, or you get the sort of Snapchat Facebook effect where these companies see a windfall of potential incremental revenue and page views and start generating content just for this platform.
Right.
You know, we saw how that happened with Facebook. The moment that the owner of the platform decides that they want to change their algorithm, or they get new human editors in who have different tastes, it just kicks the legs right out from that whole enterprise. And then, you know, another round of layoffs.
Yeah, I think Apple's messaging around being the better solution to Facebook and being the alternative to Facebook is going to be really big here. And I think especially as they look at David, you mentioned that they've put already a focus on human curation here, but they'll have a lot more in this service if these partnerships come through and it is an all-you-can-eat plan, how they plan to scale all of that and still be this, you know, unbiased platform for news consumers.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that in this Recode piece I was reading earlier, one of the things that that Apple has been promising to publishers is reportedly basically just that they're going to market it so much and talk about it so much that the audience is going to be huge. And it's like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But we've also seen lots of companies care about things just as long as they keep working and then stop talking about them. And then as soon as they stop talking about them, they disappear and then they move away from it. And like everybody has at various points said, we are deeply committed to promoting great journalism. And then they're all like, ah, that's okay. We got other things to focus on.
I mean, and also like Apple's done things like this is a case where Apple will be in control of the platform. And so not that we've seen many steps in this direction in the past. I mean, music is a very different offering, but this is news. There's a lot of other things that need to be vetted and to be they need to be prepared for there. And it will be very interesting to see the marketing message around it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's really interesting to me because it seems like the counter to the content rules everything argument 2 weeks ago, I would have said is Spotify, where you can take the same content everybody else has and remix it in different ways and have sort of interesting human curation and interesting algorithms and do cool stuff with it. But then even Spotify goes out and buys Anchor and Gimlet Media, which is this big push towards, okay, we actually need to have some content of our own to make this really work. And so it seems like the first step is figure out ways to put this together. And then the second step is going to be, what can we make that nobody else has so people have to keep coming to us? And like there were all these rumors a couple of years ago that Apple was going to buy Condé Nast and get all those big magazines out from under it. And this seems like a first step that would actually make a lot of sense with that, something like that as the second step. I have no idea how real that rumor ever was, but it does seem like the end of this road is going to be, we have to make our own stuff, which is what they've also found with TV, to your point, Christopher.
So attention. You're saying the end of this road is they're going to go buy or produce content the way that they appear to be doing with TV?
It would be one move. And I feel like we've seen in all of these other industries, whether it's music or podcasts or TV, that's where it ends. That step one is you figure out sort of ways to put it all together, which is like what Netflix did early, and you do the distribution thing, and then you quickly get to a point where you say, okay, the next thing we need to do is make it ourselves. And I wonder if Apple ends up there.
I mean, Apple, if anybody could do it, you know, the Hearst of the 21st century, Tim Cook all the way.
I like it. Over the last couple of years, a new idea has gotten a lot of interest and money in Silicon Valley, but it's actually not a new idea at all. It's food delivery, which is an extremely old idea. We've even been through this whole high-tech food delivery thing a few times before, like when Cosmo and Webvan and Urban Fetch and Pets.com and all of these other companies got huge and then basically simultaneously brought the internet bubble crashing down. But hey, fun fact, we're back. Postmates is going public. DoorDash, another startup, was valued over $6 billion, I think, recently. Uber Eats is increasingly important to Uber. We just can't stop trying to get ourselves food faster. So our own Greg Benzinger, the journal's, I think, primary food enthusiast, has been reporting on all this stuff for a while now. So he's going to come explain. Let me go get him. I'll be right back.
Joanna, do you use Uber Eats? What's your experience with it?
I've never used it.
Never? Well, that's because you're blessed to live in a city where you've already got infinite delivery options.
Greg, say hello.
Greetings.
Okay. Why is this happening again? Why all of a sudden, two decades later, are we all obsessed with high-tech food delivery again?
Turns out people are pretty lazy. They like to have things delivered. They're willing to pay a premium for it, not both on the products and the delivery fee. So it's pretty surprising to me. I mean, it's not like a innovation in the sense that you couldn't get food delivered before. You and I are old enough to remember 10 or 15 whole years ago when you could get a pizza delivered or Chinese food delivered.
And it was just like a college kid high in a car.
So. That's exactly right. I think what's succeeding now is the sort of variety of food delivery that you can get, things that you wouldn't expect before, lasagna or Burger King or McDonald's, and now Starbucks, and it just goes on and on. So there are restaurants that are devoting whole sections of their restaurants to these delivery apps, and they say it drives incremental revenue and people like it. But it's a bit mysterious to me, an old fogey.
So, and we've been
How do you get your food?
I make it at home primarily, but I also get it. I refuse to pay the premium for the delivery. I found that
you mean you get it. You order to the restaurant, presumably by a phone call.
Yeah, there's this thing you can carry it in your pocket. You can dial numbers on it, call the restaurant, and have it waiting for you when you arrive yourself. You don't pay the premium.
You yourself go get the food.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Wow. Seems like that takes so long.
That is amazing.
You can play so much Fortnite while you're going and getting your food.
It's a shocking revelation, but it's true. I do sometimes go to restaurants and pick the food up myself. I've done the price comparison,
and
there's a big markup. There's a big markup on the items themselves and the delivery cost. And then there's a tip on top of it, which you should pay, but it adds up to a lot. I'm not willing to pay that much for food that I don't even know I'll get in the time allotted. So I'll just go get it.
So this is one of the things I've actually wondered, where Uber has leaned harder and harder into Uber Eats as like a core piece of its business.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
It's just because it's working. They sometimes seem a little mystified by it, that it's worked so well. Because, you know, it was supposed to be a ride-hailing company with a few other things that it would do. And this seems to be the thing that's most likely to go profit, to reach a profit soon. It's bringing in new customers, they say, people who don't even use the ride-sharing service. It has its own devoted app, and it's just working. It's a bit, you know, it's a bit mysterious, like I said. And I don't know why people choose DoorDash or Uber Eats to get it, or Caviar, or the million other apps that do this. It's all the same service. It brings it to your door. It's just food delivery, right?
Yeah. And what's weird is some of these companies are failing. Like Munchery, didn't it just go out of business?
No, Munchery, of course, was the one that made its own food and brought it to you.
Oh, that's right.
It's one of those. And if you look at that whole sort of prepare food thing, is not working out so well. There's been a few of those failures.
But I also wonder how many more people are going to be willing to pay, you know, $37 for a $20 pizza.
Well, the cynic in me tells me that what they're assuming is you're not paying much attention. It's going to your credit card.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to just swipe and say deliver. You'll look at it at the end of the month. Maybe, I mean, how many people look at their credit card statements? So that's the idea. Just convenience. I mean, think about McDonald's, right? That doesn't travel well, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Fries, they travel very poorly. McDonald's is a huge part of Uber Eats' business. That's justified a huge part of their expansion. So what does that tell you about food delivery? People just want convenience, and they're willing to pay a premium for things like McDonald's.
And soggy fries. You know, people like soggy fries is what we're really learning.
We're in an era of soggy fries, I guess.
Yeah.
There's actually some efforts to figure out how to fry or cut or raise potatoes that travel better, specifically for food delivery in fry form. So this is a real thing.
So okay, so I've been wondering this too, actually.
This was like the best part of the conversation we had with you the last time, where we were discussing
how we're going to keep the food warm.
Right.
And tasty.
Yes.
And we were going to get outer space bags or something.
That's right. There's a tremendous amount of innovation in the food, heating, storage end of the business. Yeah.
Can I also say the competition here is not delivery. It's not like, am I going to get Chinese takeout or am I going to get McDonald's? The competition is, am I going to go to McDonald's? That convenience, and because if I go to a restaurant, I got to pay a higher tip anyway, it kind of works out.
Mm-hmm. Also, can we get a sad violin sound in there for Mims?
Me and my brood. Really?
And you and your McDonald's proximity problem.
Yeah.
But so on the flip side then, why wouldn't McDonald's just roll out its own delivery, just go back to hiring high college kids?
It's that word you just used, hiring. They don't want to do it.
There.
And they don't want to, you know, you don't want to mess with contractors too. It's a messy business and it's a complicated business. People get upset. So you pass off the responsibility of the delivery to Uber, which has its own relationship with contractors. We can get into that if you want, but of course that just makes it easier, and they take their cut, whatever it is, and it drives business out the door. So
is the
that simple.
I'm thinking the solution for McDonald's, this is what I assume they're working on, are robotic Ronald McDonald's to bring you the food
and to terrify all neighborhood children,
to kill
right?
all of us.
Deep fryers in the back seat of every car.
Joanna, that's a safe assumption.
I'm sure Ronald that McDonald's. Greg is covering it. The company that uses the industrial robots to bake the pizza in the truck as it's coming to you.
How do you know about my investment in?
I feel like you're like a treasure trove of information about what our food, like how this is changing food.
It is kind of fascinating and a little gross too when you think about it, right? The way they sort of manufacture these things. The word reconstituted comes up a lot when you see these how food is made. But you're right. There's just a desire to make this as crispy or whatever it is, hot or baked or whatever it is when it arrives at your door. So
the real question I have before we let you go is, how is this not the same thing as same number of startups raising tons of money with the same sorts of ideas, and they like broke Silicon Valley 2 decades ago. How is this not that?
Well, a couple of things. One is just the broad use and acceptance of apps and smartphones, and people being comfortable with their credit card just being stored in a sort of a device that just charges them without even thinking about it.
Which goes along with the willingness to just sort of pay for things without even noticing.
Yeah. If you remember the bad old days, if you will, of the internet, where anybody remembers Cosmo.com and the like, back then you had to go on your desktop and type it in. You had to enter your credit card again. You know, Cosmo, of course, blew up because it charged no up fee for anything.
Right.
They delivered you gum.
Which now they call it Amazon.
That's right. So it really points to the smartphone and just our willingness to let things happen behind the scenes. Just click the button on your phone and it'll come. Thinking that it's going to, it's all going to work.
What is the next tasty innovation in getting food into my mouth? Crispy fries?
They're going to be like an Amazon dash button for pizza.
My money is on sort of typing in the ingredients you want in a custom ice cream that can be frozen en route to your home. So you can have wacky flavors of ice cream while in the back of the car, it will turn into, you know, a beautiful Mims creation.
Totally believable. Here's $10 million.
Yeah. What is the future of condiments?
You do not want to go down this path with me. I believe there's a condiment lobby
big ketchup.
Well, why is every couple of years there's something that is the hot item, and you know it's jumped the shark because it eventually appears in a Subway sandwich.
Sriracha.
So sriracha, and there was chipotle was really hot for a while, like honey mustard was really hot for a while, ranch. All these things eventually end up jumping the shark because they've appeared. You know it because they've appeared ultimately on a Subway sandwich, and that's their specialty sandwich of some year. And I believe there's a sort of Illuminati of condiment people who decide what is the condiment of the year.
Do they all work for Subway?
No, they don't.
But it just runs its course.
Right, it runs its course by going to Subway. Pesto, for example.
Pesto is a great example.
Things,
yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like the condiments who pick like the Pantone color of the year, but instead it's condiments, but it happens.
That's right. And it just blows up and then it just disappears.
What is it in 2019?
You know, the best thing about condiments is it travels well, too.
That's right. That is right. I wish I knew, Pierce, what the condiment of the year was this year. I would be a multimillionaire if I knew
all right,
that.
Well, report it out and then come back to it.
I'll do my best.
Sriracha chipotle is what it is.
Awesome. Thanks, Greg.
See you guys.
Okay, we should move on. Coming up in just a second, Rolf Winkler and Anne Wojcicki.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Welcome back. Last week in San Francisco, the Journal held a conference all about health and technology. We talked about hacking your brain, selling your activity data, using robots to help the elderly, how hospitals can be redesigned and improved, and much more. It's a really interesting conference. I want to play you one quick talk with Wall Street Journal reporter Rolf Winkler and Anne Wojcicki, the CEO of 23andMe. They talked about the uses and the risks of in-home DNA tests and what it means to collect and share that kind of data. They also talked about how DNA data could make for better drugs. I've been holding off doing one of those tests for a long time myself. Something about it just makes me nervous. And it was fascinating to hear Anne and Rolf talk about it. Anyway, it was a great and important conversation. Here it is.
What is the most bonkers story you've heard of somebody discovering that, you know, their parents not their parents, their brothers aren't their brothers, you know, they're actually Jewish and who knew? You've got to hear these all the time.
You know, I would say every day, at least once a day. You know, in some ways, like some of those, like it's almost you know, in the beginning, like, we'd get a story about, oh, someone finding a family member or somebody figuring out, like, oh, their father's not their father. Like, one of our advisors, I remember calling me at one point and, like, on a panic and was like, I found out that, you know, there was fertility issues in the family, and I did, you know, 23andMe, and I found out, like, my father's not my father, and I asked my mother about it, and she's like, oh, no, 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 your father's your father. He just needed a little competition with his sperm. And so we mixed the sperm, and we just, like, but we know your father won. He just needed a little competition. And
so he did not win.
And he did not win.
Because this has struck a major chord. Is my colleague Amy Doxer Marcus in the audience somewhere? She's over in the back. She wrote a story this week about, you know, a family where the sisters did ancestry, and one sister found out that they actually have, she has a different father, and the other sister found out that her father had an affair, and so she has a half brother.
Yeah.
And so it's all a mess.
I think the thing that I've learned is that in some ways there's no family that doesn't have a story. Like, if you've done 23andMe, it's just a matter of time before you figure out your own family story.
Okay.
And so everyone has, like, we found out in ours, like, my mom's brother, you know, we thought never had children. But he was like, he had a lot of fun in the 60s. And
evidently,
it looks like he has at least one child. And we now, like, we know it's my first cousin.
Okay.
And so, you know, so everyone, it's just a matter of time. And I would say one of the most strangest stories is we did have a woman who called in once to customer care and was confused why she was called as XY. And so she was, you know, looked like she was a male, but she was a female. And then as she was talking to the customer care team, it sort of came out like, oh, wow, like, she had, you know, she'd actually had surgery when she was 13, meaning that she'd had her testes removed. And she just had no idea that that was what the surgery was. And so every so often...
Her parents didn't share that with...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one thing that you find is that there's a lot of secrets that have been kept. And, you know, I think one of the things that we had,
it's a great title of a book, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's what's interesting right now is that going forward in the future is, like, you won't have those kinds of secrets. Like, 20 years from now, everyone will think it's normal. Like, you can't keep a secret.
Okay. Well, we want to talk a little bit today about 23andMe strategy in 2018. This is direct consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So just people buying things from you. Sales grew about 5%. In 2018 versus 2017, that was this is from Second Measure.
Mm-hmm.
Is that roughly accurate for how things turned out in 2018?
Sorry, say again, that they did?
Your sales were up 5% versus 2017.
No. Our sales, in 2018? No. In 2018.
Yeah. In 2018,
no, they were up more.
5%
it was
versus,
up more.
It was up more, okay.
Correct, so it's slightly off. The market definitely slowed last year.
It did, how come?
Yeah. I think it's an interesting question because there's no doubt that there's a lot of momentum out there. I think that my hypothesis is that you have some of the effect from, you know, Facebook, people concerned about privacy, you had Golden State Killer. And so people, you know, people pause. And I think I can understand.
That's,
you know? You pause
by the way, mm-hmm. That's fascinating. The Golden State Killer, the reaction wasn't, oh my God, we got this guy. It was, oh shit, what can the government get? Can the government come get me or something?
Well, I think it's partly like because it wasn't necessarily, like people didn't, it wasn't necessarily consented in that way. You know, they didn't use 23andMe. We should make that clear. They used a public data set.
Yeah, it was a...
And I think it's more that sense of surprise. Like, well, are you okay with it? Like, without a doubt, there's people who, you know, watch America's Most Wanted and they want to be part of that. And there is a business there. But you want to know, like, are you voluntarily, you know, part of that or not? And 23andMe, from the earliest days, like, one of our board members in the earliest days, our advisors, was like, we should have a crime database. And I was like, well, like, no. So... It's a different business. And so, like, we would never participate in that. And I think it's really important for people to know that they've consented for the genetic of information to be used in a way that they're comfortable with.
Okay. So, but the next thing for you guys is drug development. This
Correct.
Is going to be a source of growth for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, are you basically like selling data to GSK or like we're selling you our data set? Is it more, we hope this co-development arrangement leads to a drug and we've got a revenue share on the back end?
We have the way it's set up. So we hired Richard Scheller, who came from Genentech. We hired him almost four years ago, specifically because we felt like drug discovery is one of those few areas in the economy that's incredibly inefficient. Like, it's almost like investigating a communist society. Like, every single year, they brag about how they get worse. So it was like $700 million to develop a drug when I first started investing, and now it's like $2 billion to develop a drug. And so the hypothesis within 23andMe was that if we start with a better data set, if we start with like actually human genetic information, will you have a higher success rate of developing a drug? Because so much of the cost of the drugs comes from failures. And so we were interested, like, I believe, and there's good data to support, that, you know, other drugs that have been developed that have a human genetic foundation have had a higher likelihood of success. So we actually have, we've developed on our own 13 compounds. Two of them are in late stage. And so
late stage
research. So they'll go into humans sometimes next year.
Which means that makes it phase three?
No, sorry. So this is like before it's even in humans. It's not in humans yet. It's still in research.
Okay.
So it's in the research phase. It's in animal testing, like all of that, like all the early research phase, like say, is it safe enough to go into humans?
Okay.
And so then after that, you'd file an IND, an investigational new drug.
So you hope there's going to be 23andMe branded drugs on the market at some point.
For sure. I would love to be able, like, for me, it's a source of pride. If I can go back to my lupus community at some point and say, you know, because of your participation and the participation of all the people who opted to be a control, like, we've helped find something that's going to make your life better.
Okay. I want to ask you about that New York Times editorial from a week ago, titled "Why You Should Be Careful About 23andMe's Health Test."
Yeah.
It's a tough editorial. Basically, they said, you know, they looked at your BRCA test mainly, and they said, look, for the 11 million people that are Ashkenazi Jews out there, 2% are going to get a positive result. They're going to have to confirm that with a clinical test. 98% are going to get a negative result. That doesn't rule out the risk. They're going to need to get a clinical test. For the rest of humanity, it's not useful. They're going to need to get a clinical test. So the conclusion was, basically, this is, as they called it, more parlor trick than medicine. If you're concerned about genetic susceptibility to cancer or other diseases, it's best to see a doctor. Mm-hmm. Don't use 23andMe. What's your response?
I think there's a couple interesting things happening right now, because I think that there's something really disruptive about the combination of technology and healthcare. And I think that it does start to disrupt exactly what the role is with the physician. And it's one of the things that was particularly controversial about 23andMe is that we worked really hard specifically to prove that consumers are capable of getting genetic information on their own without a physician. And it's without a physician or a genetic counselor that's sort of like the key buzzwords that like created a lot of controversy. And we have a system right now that's really the gatekeeper is the physician. And so there's somewhat of a disruption about who should be that gatekeeper for access. So a lot of this, in my mind, comes from the question of like, well, who's actually, like, who gets to give out this information? Like, you can't just give out this information. So
it's not just that. It's like, what information are they getting?
Well,
the information you can give them versus what a full clinical workup can give them is much
correct.
Less.
So for instance, like when you go to the doctor, if I present and I say, I have a family history where everyone in my family has died of sudden cardiac disease, and you go to the doctor and they say, no one in my family has died of sudden cardiac disease, we're going to have a different workup. But we're still going to get a cholesterol test, which is like a relatively basic kind of screen. Mm-hmm. So what 23andMe has done is that we have taken some of the most common genetic variants that are found in the population. So one thing I would argue the New York Times got wrong is like, it's these three mutations make up 80% of the breast cancer cases in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. They're by far the most common. So if you're of Ashkenazi descent, these are really important to test. And so we never go out and say, hey, if you have a hereditary family history of breast cancer, you should get 23andMe. In fact, if you asked and you said, hey, I have a family history of cancer, should I do 23andMe? I would say no. But we're a really phenomenal screen that's really broad, that tests across a number of mutations that are commonly found in the population. And one of the most important things, and I would argue like they missed our publication. We have a great publication that came out and it showed specifically is that a lot of the customers we find who are finding that they have this BRCA mutation never would have qualified for the reimbursed screening. So you routinely, like one of the people who's like, who's gone and done testimonials for us, who's in New York, who's really active about this. He's like, my wife was specifically denied genetic testing, even though her sister died early and they are of Jewish descent. She was told she was not eligible for it. And then she found on 23andMe that she was. So I think part of the issue at hand here is specifically about access. Like, who controls the access point for getting this information? And right now, like, one of the things that's tragic in this country is that it's really hard sometimes to qualify for the care. If you want to get this information, it's hard and it's expensive.
And what happens? So what? Another thing you mentioned, though, this was in your letter in response, women who carry one of the variants we test for have a 45 to 85% risk of developing breast cancer versus 12.4% in the general population. This is knowledge that may help you go get qualified for a workup.
Correct.
But then I look at the fine print on your website, and it says things, it says, quote, these carrier reports are not intended to tell you anything about your risk for developing a disease in the future. Mm-hmm. So how do I square you saying that you've got a higher likelihood of developing this based on my test with fine print that says, you know, it's not intended to tell you anything. It's not intended to diagnose any disease.
And so there's a difference between saying you have a risk factor. And so,
but that's not what it actually says. It says not intended to tell you anything about your risk for developing a disease in the future, for developing a disease.
Well, I think this is where you follow up with your physician. Like, for me, one of the most important things is getting the confirmatory testing. Like, you go, if you find out that you're a carrier for a mutation, like for me personally, even if I was in the clinic, I would not go and decide to get a mastectomy off one test. And so one of the special controls that the FDA definitely was worried about is like wanting to make sure that people were going to get confirmatory testing. And so we accepted a lot of the parts of the label because we agree, like you should not lob off part of your body based on one test. And so getting confirmatory testing, I think, is actually an important part of it.
Do you say that on your website that it's important to do this in conjunction with a clinical test?
I think it's exactly like people should get this and then they go in and they confirm it. And I think the same way, like if you get a clinical test, it was one of the arguments that we also had is that like if you go and you get one of the clinical tests, there was no confirmatory test at the time when we started working on this.
The last question on that is just why market something that's called a genetic health risk test if, you know, the fine print at the bottom says, you know, this doesn't describe a person's overall risk of developing a disease, not intended to tell you anything about your current state of
health. I think those are really broad statements that in some ways, like if you read the reports, like part of the purpose of saying that is also help people.
Those are broad statements from your website.
Correct. Exactly. But that's the special controls from the FDA. And so part of the purpose of saying that too is something like breast cancer also is impacted based on like, what was the age of your first pregnancy? Like, do you smoke? You know, what's your ethnicity? So there's other factors at play here. And I think it's one of those things that we say is like, it's important. If you come have a family history, if you are worried about breast cancer and you have a family history of breast cancer, and there's all kinds of reasons, 100% go and see a genetic counselor and see a physician, and you might qualify. But for a lot of people in this country, they are not necessarily proactively thinking about any of these types of risks. Like I said, I look at the Delta 5, the cystic fibrosis mutation. Most people we find like have no idea. So I think what we do is we capture a lot of people who are interested in this idea. We capture a broad swath of like just of you know, relatively common genetic variants, but it's not a comprehensive cancer screen.
Okay. One other tough one I wanted to ask you, if it's okay, was about there was an article in the journal Nature back in March of 2018 that this was about direct consumer genetic tests generally. And it said, when we compare the DTC result with the full workup result, we're finding 40% of the tests, the DTC tests, have false positives. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you guys have done testing comparing your results to full clinical workups. What's your false positive rate?
I mean, this is like, we go through the FDA process. Like, there's a reason our first submission was like 7,000 pages. Like, the amount of accuracy, like clinical, like the accuracy that we have to prove, the clinical validity. And I would point to the fact that the majority of other clinical tests, the laboratory developed tests that are out there, never go through FDA review.
You do, but what's the, but
We have a 99.9% accuracy. I mean, our concordance...
Your false positive rate. So what they found, 40% false positives for DTC tests, that doesn't apply to you at all. You never have that. That never happens.
We do not have... I mean, if you... You have to define false positive.
You're right. I guess I do. What?
Right. So the question.
I'm sure you read this article. How did he define it?
I don't remember the article on it. What we have found more often than not, the way that we have converted some of the leaders of genetic testing centers. Like we had one of the largest genetic testing centers was like, I was told I'm not a carrier for hematomicrosis. And then did 23andMe, found us, was like, oh, look, you guys are wrong. Like you told me I'm a carrier for hematomicrosis. Went and then sequenced herself and was like, wow, like you were right. And so more often than not, like the technology is one of the beauties of the genotyping technology is it's incredibly accurate. And it's just we're held to a much higher bar because there's not a physician involved, and so our accuracy, our false positive, false negative, is pretty extraordinary. In part because
what is it? As you define it, what's that?
It's I don't remember the specific
0.9
numbers on
to 0.1 or
it's like we don't have errors. I mean, it's very 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 rare.
And that's our show, everybody. Thanks to Anne and Rolf, Greg, Christopher, and Joanna for being here. And thanks to Tanya, our producer. And thank you for listening. We have new episodes on Fridays. So as always, make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. I've been using Castro recently. It's very good. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.